Good morning and welcome to OESA's podcast series. In this podcast, we get to explore topical economic issues and see how they affect our daily lives here in South Africa. We get to speak to experienced and knowledgeable people in our field. I'm your host, Margot G, and with me today is Johannes Fedeke, a professor at Penn State who has worked extensively in the South African economy. Hello and welcome to our podcast. Could you please tell us a little bit more about yourself?
Yes, hi Margot. Thanks very much for inviting me. my name is Johannes Fedeke, and I'm born and raised. Did my initial training in South African universities, graduate school in the UK, and have been a professor of economics in various institutions, including in South African universities. My particular area of interest is economic growth, which essentially addresses the question of why some countries are rich and some countries are poor. I have worked extensively both on theoretical questions regarding economic growth determinants, but also empirically on experiences of growth across the world and in South Africa specifically. Currently, as you've mentioned, I'm at Penn State. I'm a professor at Penn State. But my interest continues in South Africa, and I'm still working on the South African economy to some extent.
Thank you. What a pleasure to have you with us. We are currently experiencing a severe shock to our world economy with this coronavirus, and we've been looking at this in a number of podcasts lately. So, could you tell us more about how this virus has been spreading throughout the world and what differential impact it has across various regions?
Yes, so let me just show you a graphic that should help illustrate this question. So the first question to ask is just how much of an impact different countries have actually experienced and how this has been unfolding over time. And the first point to make is that it's actually very time sensitive as to how you look at the spread of the virus. So what I'm showing you here is the number of reported and confirmed cases of the coronavirus across a range of countries. And I'm reporting it over the space of a very constrained time period. This is across the space of only 3 days. And one thing that you can note is if you take a look at the United States experience, for instance, you can see just how rapidly the number of reported and confirmed cases is increasing from day to day. This is from the 24th of March to the 25th of March to the 26th of March. You move from the blue to the orange to the gray line, and you can see that it's on a very rapid rate of increase. Now, having said that, this is not universally true. Different countries have experienced the spread somewhat differentially. Take a look at South Korea. South Korea has essentially been flatlining on the number of reported cases, confirmed cases, as has China. So this raises a number of different questions. And by the way, a further point to make is that the Italian case continues to show a steady increase of cases, but it's not showing the rate of increase, the very rapid acceleration that you see in the United States. So this raises a number of questions. One is whether the measurements of confirmed cases are in fact accurate. Is South Korea measuring this in the same way as the United States is measuring, as Italy is measuring it, as China is measuring it? So it's a question of whether this is an accurate reflection of the case, of the cases that are being reported. But it also indicates that there may well be a differential experience because of the different types of policy responses that different countries have adopted to the spread of the virus. So some countries have gone for very, very draconian measures of complete lockdowns. India is the latest case that has adopted a very draconian response. Whereas other countries, such as Germany, for instance, have taken a somewhat more moderate approach, whereby they have steadily increased the measures that they've employed to limit the spread of the virus. But they still allow more extensive interaction between people than in cases where there's been a complete lockdown. The other point that's really worth making is that not only is there a very differential rate of infection across countries, obviously larger countries with larger populations are going to report a larger number of cases, and the number of cases confirmed doesn't normalize or adjust at all for the underlying population size. So an alternative way of looking at this is just to think about what the mortality impact is. So of the number of cases that are confirmed for the coronavirus, what proportion of the people who are confirmed to be infected actually die? And I'm also showing you exactly the same actually across 4 days, the 22nd of March going to the 24th, to the 25th and the 26th. And again, you see a quite differential impact across countries. So you find some countries such as Italy with a relatively high mortality rate. And what Italy has been showing is a steadily climbing mortality rate. So it started off at just above 9% on the 22nd of March, and only 4 days later, it had climbed to more than 10% of confirmed cases reporting mortality, so essentially dying. In addition, I mean, you have Spain, which has a relatively high mortality rate, and even countries such as the United Kingdom, which haven't reported a very high number of absolute cases confirmed with the coronavirus, but they are reporting a relatively high mortality rate of around 5%. And even countries such as the Netherlands, notice the Netherlands has been increasing very rapidly over the last 4 days in terms of its mortality rate. A country such as the Netherlands reporting a mortality rate north of 5%. Now let's contrast that a little bit with the experience of countries that we see at this bottom end of the distribution here. You've got a set of countries such as Germany, Austria, Australia, Singapore, and Norway that are reporting a mortality rate that is below 0.5 of 1%, so half of 1%. In the case of Germany, it's fairly stable across these 4 days at about half of 1%. In fact, in the case of Germany, it's about 0.4 of 1%. So you have these very differential impacts of the virus in terms of the impact that it actually has on mortality. And the question is why this might be the case. And there's a number of possibilities. One possibility is that Germany is just measuring the mortality different, or that it's measuring the actual incidence of the disease somewhat differently from other countries. But given the quality of the health system in Germany, that is not entirely convincing as an explanation. The other possibility is that Germany has a much younger population than Italy, for instance. So Italy may be experiencing a very high mortality rate because it has a relatively old population. It's the second oldest population in the world. But it's also not clear that that explanation is all that convincing, because Japan is the country with the oldest recorded population in the world. And you can see that while it has a relatively high mortality rate of about 3.5%, certainly high compared to a country like Germany, it is nonetheless a relatively old population. The other thing to note about Japan, by the way, is that they seem to have a very small number of recorded cases being reported. So a third possibility is that the policy response of countries such as Italy and Germany have been quite different through the unfolding of the crisis. So what is distinctive about countries such as Germany and Singapore and South Korea, for that matter, is that they adopted a response of quite heavy testing, quite intensive testing for the coronavirus early on, and then targeting the isolation and the quarantining of individuals with a confirmed infection and a confirmed case of the coronavirus right away. So it points already to the fact that how you respond to the infection and the intensity of the infection that you face is going to be crucial as to what the impact is going to be on the patients that confirm infection.
Yeah,
so that's just by way of background information on just how this actually has unfolded.
This is very interesting when you analyze it in that way. If we look at your first graph, I think it leads very much to the flattening of the curve that people are talking about. And what's interesting is I think different countries are at different stages of, you know, the exposure to the virus. So if you look at China, the news came out a few months ago and they've already come a far way to flattening the curve. So it might be expected that exponential increase isn't there. But I think if you look at the countries like Germany, we could learn a lot from how efficiently they adopted those preventative measures and screened everybody early on to prevent the contamination of the virus.
I think I may just suggest. I think that there's a number of countries that we stand to learn a lot from. I think the countries that we should look closely at are Germany, as you mentioned, but also South Korea, Singapore, Taiwan have all been relatively successful, it seems, at keeping mortality rates low. And I think Japan is also an interesting test case, precisely because they've got an old population and they've managed to keep the infection rate low. So the number of confirmed cases remains remarkably low. And so it's not so much that they've kept the mortality rate down, but they've kept the number of infections down. So I think all of those cases are particularly interesting. And I think it might be useful to contrast that with Italy, with the United Kingdom for that matter, and with the United States. United Kingdom adopted an interesting policy initially of allowing the infection to, in a sense, having a weaker policy response, allowing therefore the infection to spread faster on the understanding that you would expect the population to become immune over time. But it seems as if that may well have been a mistake, at least on the current data. And of course, one has to qualify this in saying, these are very early days. We're going to have to look at this data extensively over the future in order to draw the correct lessons and the correct inferences. But the high mortality rate in the United Kingdom suggests that may not have been a very the right policy intervention. And certainly they seem to have reversed that approach and have gone for much more dramatic attempts to limit lockdowns and preventative measures of having people interact with one another.
Definitely, and timing is everything. I must say, I think we can commend South Africa on how efficiently it has handled this. The lockdown is happening, and this morning our count was about 700 people. So it's still very early days, and I think to initiate a lockdown so early on is definitely quite a good thing. What I find fascinating...
If I can just suggest, though, I think countries like South Africa are going to have to watch the space quite carefully because, if you take a look at the African region, it's true that there are relatively limited cases being reported, but that may well be the case because the health systems are not able to actually record the true infection rate. And I think a warning signal actually comes from countries such as Zimbabwe and Gabon. Zimbabwe has a mortality rate of 33% on the coronavirus. Wow. It's the highest in the world. Wow. Now, again, that may be just a measurement issue. It may be a function of the fact that in Zimbabwe, because of the ongoing crisis in the economy, the only people who actually go to be recorded are ones that are already very seriously ill, of whom then fairly high proportion then actually do experience mortality, die from the infection. But Bangladesh too is a warning sign. And the mortality rate in Bangladesh stands at 11%. So I think developing countries and emerging markets certainly face a very significant challenge. And given that South Africa's population is already challenged by virtue of a compromised immune system through the HIV/AIDS infection rate, I think it is a very challenge to the South African economy.
Yeah, and I think it's definitely going to be testing whatever infrastructure we have in our healthcare system at the moment.
Sure is.
And I think one thing is looking at the shock, but the other is looking at the long-term effect. So short-term, we are expecting fairly high mortality rates. I hope it's not as high as we expect. But what does this then mean for employment and growth down the line?
So I think the impact of this is going to be unprecedented. This morning, the United States released its unemployment claims for the last week, and it recorded 3.3 million unemployment claims being filed in the last week alone. Now, contrast that with the past and historical experience of the United States. The previous absolute peak of weekly unemployment claims being filed was 695,000, which was in 1982.
Wow.
So this is at least five times as high just for 1 week. And certainly the US Treasury is already projecting that the unemployment rate in the United States may peak at between 20 and 30% as the crisis unfolds. Now that in turn means that when we were at the peak of the 2007-2008 crisis, at the peak of that, we were at 10% unemployment rate. If you are talking 20 to 30% unemployment rate, we're talking essentially 1929 and the Great Depression. And in fact, beyond that, if we hit 30%, this is going to be unprecedented. So the impact on employment in the United States alone is going to be very, very large indeed. Certainly one hears ongoing reports of people, that are employed by small and medium-sized enterprises facing furloughs and facing being laid off. So the impact on employment is going to be very large. The associated impact on GDP is going to therefore be symmetrical. It's going to be equally large. The estimates for the first year, the first quarter growth for the United States prior to last week's unemployment statistics being released, we're already suggesting that growth would range anywhere between 0% and -5% on GDP, which may be perhaps a little bit on the pessimistic side. But for the second quarter, it's much, much worse. So the estimates are now ranging between a contraction of the US economy of between 14% and 25% to 30% in the second quarter of 2020. So, you know, that matches essentially the impact that is being predicted from the unemployment statistics. And so what we're facing is that a prospect that something between 8.5 and 14 million jobs in the United States may be destroyed or disappear over the coming months. And the impact of that in turn on the on long-term welfare consequences for the US population is going to be very large. It's going to have consequences for people's ability to consume. It's going to have consequences for people's ability to pay for education, and particularly higher education. It's going to have consequences for people's ability to buy healthcare. So the public health consequences are going to stretch beyond just the immediate coronavirus impact and the mortality rate that results from that, to beyond that, to people's ability to take care of their health needs that arise more generally, just from completely corona factors that are unrelated to the coronavirus.
Definitely, very interesting. So you've spoken a lot about America and their unemployment. Do we know much about China's unemployment and how it's been affected from this? I think they've got very different ways of handling the situation and very different governments. What role do you think that has, if any?
So actually, I'm not aware of any reports on unemployment in China. Certainly, there are strong indications that GDP in China has received a very strong negative shock. I mean, whether how big that's going to be in due course, I'm not sure we fully understand that yet. But it's certainly going to be the worst quarter for Chinese growth over the last 30 years. That actually now matters for the world economy because it is the second largest economy in the world after the United States. And historically, the United States has always served as the locomotive of the world economy. And what we now face is a situation where the second largest economy in the world and an economy which is a substantial part of the world manufacturing base is now experiencing a very large negative shock. So there's going to be a strong negative supply side shock that emerges from the contraction in the Chinese, or this, at least a slowdown, possibly a contraction in the Chinese economy. And that's going to have consequences for the rest of us. There's going to be knock-on effects that all countries around the world are going to feel.
Definitely. I think we could definitely take some learnings from, you know, the different economies or the different governments in terms of at least the healthcare sector and the mortality rates. But I think there might also be learnings down the line in terms of how unemployment and growth is affected. I think a lot of this also depends on the various policy responses. There's a responsibility with the monetary policy and fiscal policy. Which do you think matters more? Are these the only policy responses we could have? Could you tell us more about that?
So again, I mean, I think we're in relatively uncharted territories. We've never been in this type of situation before. And I'll explain that in a number of dimensions in a moment. We've certainly experienced very significant negative shocks to economic activity before. I mean, the Great Depression of the 1930s is one example. The Great Contraction of 2007 and 2008 is another example. And I think in this particular instance, what is unprecedented is that we are effectively, in a very significant way, by a policy intervention, shutting down a significant part of the supply side of the economy. Production in the economy is going to be very significantly negatively influenced. Now, if you take a look at the policy responses around the world, I mean, you're seeing responses. Certainly, monetary authorities are increasing liquidity very substantially. And this is certainly true in the United States. It's certainly true of the European Central Bank. And the South African Reserve Bank has also taken significant steps by, you know, lowering interest rates by 100 basis points to increase liquidity in the economy. But since this is a supply side shock, monetary authorities have relatively limited tools at their disposal to counter that, at least in an immediate sense. Any intervention by a central bank is going to have very long lag effects, and so it's going to take a significant amount of time for it to work itself into the real economy, if at all. So what you're then thrown back on is a much greater reliance on a fiscal intervention. The United States has just announced, or has just agreed, Congress has just agreed to a $2.2 trillion stimulus to the economy. Now that's an 11% of GDP stimulus that they are launching. And that is actually, in relative terms, relatively small. A surprise here is actually Germany again, because they've announced a stimulus of 800 billion euros, which amounts to something like a 24 to 25% of German GDP stimulus to the German economy. Now, this is from fiscal authorities that have historically been the most conservative and the most constrained in providing positive stimulus through fiscal intervention. So you can see that the Germans are responding extremely aggressively on the fiscal side in order to try and stimulate the German economy. And given that Germany is particularly reliant on exports and therefore will be disproportionately significant, you know, faces disproportionate negative shock from the decline in world demand, that is some sort of indication of just how severe the authorities they are anticipating the negative shock to be.
Wow.
So you could argue that the 2.2 million trillion, sorry, definitely not million, trillion stimulus on the part of the US authorities is actually relatively conservative if you compare it to the Germans, for instance, in this particular instance. But I anticipate that in the US, this will be the first intervention and that you may actually see two or three more stimulus packages that emerge as the crisis unfolds. So we'll have to see just how large the stimulus effect is going to, the stimulus intervention is going to be. So that gives you some sort of idea of what the magnitude of the interventions that are going to be required is going to be. But I think we also face unprecedented challenges here. We are essentially shutting down a significant part of the economy. And as you try to start up the economy again, the difficulty that you actually face now is going to be, particularly for small and medium-sized economies, how to actually stimulate economic activity in that part of the economy is going to be particularly challenging. Because if you're a small and medium-sized business owner, you are dependent on anticipating a growth in demand for your products. You can only afford to ramp up your supply response once you actually experience sufficient demand. But the demand in turn will only come if people actually are in employment. So you face a chicken and egg problem. Without the supply side responding in order to create production, people aren't going to go back into employment in order to then generate the demand that they face. So I think what we actually face is that we are going to have to think very, very creatively in order to make sure that the demand and supply side responses are sufficiently coordinated so that you solve this chicken and egg problem as the crisis unfolds and as you try to reactivate the economy. Yeah. I can't think of historical examples where we faced a similar sort of challenge. And so we're going to have to think creatively and aggressively on how to actually ameliorate the effects of the negative shock.
Definitely. And I think the beauty of economics is it lies in understanding those incentives. And yes. I know the stimulus packages, I know in South Africa, we've got a lot of funding that's become available for small businesses trying one's best to help them. But I think another important thing to be mindful of is the information that people are receiving, because the expectations or the panic that people, their behavior almost becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And if they look at, you mentioned earlier, the releasing the information of the high employment levels in America, people panic, they're going to respond differently. So perhaps some of the solutions could lie in trying to change human behavior and give them the right message. But it's certainly not a simple task.
My answer to that would be that it, good luck with that. I mean, it's not very, very difficult to change human behavior. And I think part of the problem may be, so part of the US stimulus package actually involves what amounts to a basic income grant, giving every American who earns less than a cutoff of $150,000 a year, essentially $1,200 as a check. Essentially gets issued to every American citizen. Now that's fine, but the problem may be that under circumstances where you face such a big negative shock, where people become very uncertain about the future, the response may not be the intended one of increasing expenditure, increasing it, using it to spend on consumption. The response may actually be that you actually use it to increase your precautionary savings. And so the stimulus effect may be smaller than you might anticipate. Again, we don't really know, because this is unprecedented. We'll have to find out whether it works, to what extent it works. I hope it does, but there are also certainly significant downside risks that attach to the way in which this stimulus package is going to unfold.
Yeah, very, very interesting times we live in. Thank you. Is there anything else you would like to say for our listeners?
It's again a note of caution, I think, for South Africa. I mean, again, my concern about the South African circumstances, first of all, the vulnerability of the population to this infection, given the state of the immune systems of the South African population. So the impact is potentially very dramatic. But I think the second concern that I have for South Africa is, unfortunately, South Africa has less fiscal space than it ideally should have. The budget that was tabled earlier this year, in February, already contained a deficit of 6.8% of GDP. And that size of deficit already implies that South Africa was already very significantly dependent on debt financing for its fiscal expenditure. And that certainly limits the amount of space that it has to continue going for an expansionary stimulus through the fiscal response. So I fear that South Africa may actually be quite constrained in this space, and more than it should be, precisely because fiscal policy hasn't been sufficiently prudent over the last 4 or 5 years. And so I think that there's concern about South Africa being able to expand fiscal expenditure sufficiently in the current context. So I hope that is not true and that they will find the space, but I certainly have misgivings and concerns.
Well, I guess time will tell, and hopefully it'll not be as scary as it might be.
All right.
But thank you very much for your time, Professor, and I appreciate having the opportunity to have you on the show. Thank you also to all the listeners. And remember, for more updates on our podcast series, please see our website and our social media platforms. This is your host, Margot G, from Ursa Podcast Series. Till next time.